Tuesday nights, we do informational presentations with the PowerPoint. Sundays is more inspirational. And then on the Tuesday nights, it's more informational, sort of the nuts and bolts about Krishna consciousness. Of course, here's a picture of the founder, Acharya of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. He established 108 centers all over the world between years of 65 and 77 when he passed away. And then since 77, the number of temples have expanded to about 400 all over the world. And the teachings are based on the teachings of Krishna to Arjuna, as stated in the great classic Bhagavad Gita, or Song of God. Krishna is the figure who is driving the chariot, and Arjuna is the warrior figure behind, who is in the process of pulling an arrow from his quiver. Just before the onset of a great war, Arjuna had some doubts about the righteousness of the battle. He had some hesitations, and Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita to him in 700 verses and convinced him that he would be more derelict in his duty by not fighting than he would by fighting. Arjuna is trained as a warrior, and warriors are like surgeons. Surgeons cannot be afraid of blood. If a surgeon employs a knife to remove a cancerous tumor from the body, then that's actually a beneficial use of the knife. So war is not always bad. We try to avoid it as much as we can. We try to live peaceful lives. But every once in a while, it actually becomes necessary, just like it's necessary to sometimes exercise the body from a cancerous organ or a cancerous tumor. So Krishna begins the lesson of the Bhagavad Gita. First of all, he explains that Arjuna thinks that if he fights, he'll kill the opposite soldiers. I mean, that's a reasonable assumption, right? If I fight, shoot arrows at them, they'll die, right? And I'll be the cause of their death. But Krishna says, actually, the person within the body is eternal. And so there's really, in a higher sense, nothing really dies. Matter returns to matter. Dust you are come from, and dust you return. And the soul can never be destroyed. One poet said, "Howsoever turned or tossed, not even a wreath of mist is lost. No atom can itself exhaust. So shall the soul's superior force live on and run its endless course in God's unlimited universe." So even matter follows the law of conservation of matter. Even matter is not lost. It may transform its state from liquid to gaseous and then to solid. But there is no matter which is lost. Then how can the spirit which animates this material body be lost when the much inferior energy is never lost? So Krishna explains that within the body, within the material body, which is compared to a tree, there are two souls, just like you see two birds here. And you notice that one bird has some sort of fruit in his mouth, and the other bird is just kind of standing behind him and witnessing what he's doing. And then below you have the images of the individual soul, and apparently in this picture he's not up to anything very good. This action here is certainly going to yield him a bad negative result in the past. And so we can understand that the fruit he's eating, every tree has some fruits, and some of them are bitter and some of them are sweet. So based on the choices that we make, we reap a certain result, or we reap a certain harvest based on what we sow. As you sow, so you shall reap. What we reap, the fruits that we reap of insensitive cruel deeds are very bitter. And the fruits that we reap of philanthropic, altruistic, good Samaritan type activities are very, very sweet. So for every action, there's an opposite and equal reaction. But actually, good and bad, as I just described in the material world, are both bad because they're both entangling. They both keep you chained to the cycle of birth and death. If you do good acts, then you get a good birth. If you do bad acts, you get a bad birth. If you do good acts, you come back in order to enjoy the fruits of your good activities. If you do bad acts, you come back to enjoy the bitter fruits of your bad activities. So, although you come back in a better situation in the former case, and you come back in a less better situation in the latter case, the point is that you came back. And why would we want to come back to this material world when we're eternal spirit souls? And how can anything that brings us be back to this material world of birth that's actually ultimately be called good. And so in the relative world, what we call good and bad are both bad because they keep us in this world of both and birth and death. And so Krishna, who is the witnessing bird here, he accompanies the individual soul. In our conditioned state where we're revolving, after all, at the time you leave this body, whatever your thoughts are, whatever your desires are, whatever it is that you want most strong, that you're going to get. You're going to get a body just suitable to continue the desires of your previous life. So if you have material desires at the time of death, then a material body is awarded one. One takes another material body as an instrument to fulfill those material desires. So in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, don't waste your time trying to get a better material situation. Use the same amount of time and energy that you would trying to better your material situation and use it for yoga. And in this sense, he means a lot more by the word yoga than just physical exercise. Yoga means union or link. Krishna says, use the time and the energy that you have in this human life to link with God, to reestablish our lost connection with the Supreme Lord, so that at the time of death, we will have as our greatest desire to serve the Lord. If we serve the Lord now by singing and dancing and cooking for Him and organizing festivals like Saturday's festivals, sharing the philosophy, if we get a taste for doing these things, then as we enjoy serving the Lord in this life, then we will simply want to continue that in the next life. And then the instrument for doing that is no longer a material body, whether it be good or bad, but it's a spiritual body. It's called Siddha Shurup, the eternally perfected body of the living being. And we have a spiritual body now, but it's just an embryonic form. It's in seed-like form. If you imagine the physical part of ourselves that we can see as like a coat, like a winter coat, and then the mental aspect or the psychic aspect as like the shirt inside the coat. And then inside the shirt and the coat, then there's the real person, which is an eternal spirit soul. Now, spirit soul is not large. That soul which is residing in the core of the heart is described as 10,000 the size of a tip of a hair. 1/10,000 size of a tip of a hair. So it's very small. You can't even see it with a microscope, but that does not mean it doesn't have form. That it is small does not mean that it is formless. It has form. In fact, your eternal spiritual form is encapsulated within that tiny, tiny spirit soul. I gave the example some time ago of a banyan tree in the Calcutta Botanical Gardens. It's been there for 500 years. It spreads itself out over many, many acres of land. The banyan trees don't have big trunks. They just have normal-sized trunks. But as the branches spread out, then they put some branches vertically. And that's how the banyan tree spreads. It like props itself up as it spreads out. So this banyan tree is so big, it spans, you know, a couple of acres. And it's 500 years old. But 500 plus years ago, that entire huge banyan tree was, the whole blueprint, the whole form of that tree was contained within a little seed. The whole form of that tree was contained within a little seed. So although our spiritual form is very small, almost infinitesimal, and it's a seed-like form, by engaging our senses in the service of the Lord, the spiritual form actually blossoms and grows within this material body. And so those who spend their lives serving the Lord, and even if you don't dedicate yourself fully, 100%, 24/7, whatever one does in the service of the Lord, whether it's just chanting Hare Krishna a little bit, reading Bhagavad Gita a little bit, or taking a little prasadam, or throwing colors a little bit, and hearing the chanting of the Maha Mantra, whatever advancement one makes in one life, say one becomes 2% Krishna or Allah or Jehovah or God conscious, that remains in one's bank account, in one's spiritual bank account, so that when one resumes the process of serving the Lord, one begins where one is left off. If one does 2% in one life, one begins at 3%. But if you want to like finish up in this life or in the very near future and not want to come back or sojourn or muck around, you might say, in this material world, then you would try to engage yourself fully in serving the Lord. When you're not philosophizing or discussing with others, then you could be singing and dancing. And when you're not singing and dancing, you're sitting down and you're taking spiritual food offered to the Lord. And when you're not doing that, you're cleaning the temple. And when you're not doing that, you're sending out an email newsletter or working on the website or any number of things. From one thing to another, to another, to another. Variegated activities, but with one commonality, that they're all organized for the satisfaction of the Lord. It's like in my body. My finger does a different task than the ear, which does a different task than the nose, which does a different task from the feet. They all have different tasks, different characteristics. But what's common to all of them is that they work for the satisfaction of the whole. They all gather food and cook it and prepare it and put it in the mouth. And then when the food gets to the stomach, then all the various parts of the body are benefited. So there are a number, as many things as one does for oneself, with a few exceptions like intoxication, meat eating, gambling, and illicit sex. But all those wholesome things that one does for oneself could be transformed into devotional activities, which are actually performed for the satisfaction of God. And ironically, when we try to please ourselves, we don't do it. We don't do it. It's like the finger. The finger, acting independently, cannot enjoy ice cream, cannot enjoy sweet rice. It's not equipped to enjoy the taste of sweet rice. The finger, trying to, for self, fails miserably. But when it relinquishes a nice spoon of ice cream, cream cheese, to the stomach, then not only does the finger get nourishment and vitality, but the whole body does too. So the irony is that the more we try to enjoy for ourselves, just like this bird, the more he tries to enjoy the fruits of the tree for himself, the more miserable he becomes and the more frustrated he becomes. Because he's not constitutionally made to be able to enjoy independently from God. But when we give up, when we surrender to God and then fashion our activities for his sake, then we really enjoy it, because that's how we're made. We're not made as God, but we're made as servants of God, and our satisfaction can never be found in being God, but always in serving the Lord. And again, as soon as the finger or the hand gives up the ice cream for the whole, then it actually enjoys on a level it could never enjoy independently. So that's Krishna's advice to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita. He's not going to interfere with our independence. He's not going to interfere. Someone says, I can do whatever I want. Nobody can tell me what to do. Scripture, Bible, parents, teachers, politicians, you know, I get to do what I want. And that's true. Nobody can tell you what to do. No one can stop you from what you're going to do. That's true. But what you need to realize is that whatever choices you make in life, there are going to be consequences to those choices. And when those consequences come, remember what you said, that you can do whatever you want, you can make any choice, so then at least be man enough, at least be woman enough, to stand up and accept responsibility for the consequences of the choices that you make. Whatever the taste of these fruits are, the bird is more interested in enjoying the fruits of the tree than he is in turning around and looking at his well-wishing friend, the Lord. And the Lord doesn't interfere. If we were forced to love God, that wouldn't be love. He wouldn't want us that way. He doesn't want to love automatons. He doesn't want to love robots. He wants to love us as we are, in our deepest, innermost selves. And the only way that intimacy can come about is that if we, due to our own realization and our own intelligence, if we voluntarily turn everything towards Him. Only in that way can the sweet, intimate, everlasting relationship that the Lord hankers for be established and consummated. And so the Lord is not going to coerce us in any way, shape, or form. This is a bad picture. It's kind of washed out, but it's the same. I can't even see it. I think it's the same idea of the two birds in the tree. You see, the one is Krishna, the super soul, and then the other one here is the individual living being. This is another better picture. I spoke earlier about the coverings of the soul. And you see the little glowing ember in the area of the chest. That's the individual soul. which is described as 1/10,000 the size of a tip of a hair. Very small, but very powerful. Just like if you take a drop of cyanide, it will immediately act on the whole physiognomy and shut it down. So similarly, although it's very small, the soul is very powerful. It can motivate this entire bag of bones and blood in there for a lifespan of 60 or 70. And then you see the Supreme Soul, which is a picture of the Lord, alongside the individual soul in the region of the heart. Now the coverings are eightfold, as I mentioned before. There are three mental or subtle coverings, mind, intelligence, and false ego. And then you proceed to the outer, grosser material coverings, which are earth, air, fire, water, and ether. So here you have sort of an artist's conception of the total package. You see the gross elements, water there, air there, earth there, some fire, and then you can't really see the subtle elements, although they're inferred probably by his left hand there, I suppose. And then inside is the spirit self and the supreme soul. And if you didn't have the soul in the body, it wouldn't move. A motor car is all very fine and nicely engineered with engine and clutches and gears and carburetor and transmission, but if you don't have a driver, it's not going to do anything. It's just going to sit there. It's going to be a useless piece of junk. It only comes to life, accelerates, starts, stops, turns left, turns right, when there's an intelligent, individual, sentient living being in there. So what's really valuable about us is not our arms and not our legs and not even our mind, but what's really valuable about us is that eternal spirit soul, which is in the heart of every living being. And if you love your wife, you love your husband, you love your children, I present it to you that you love, really what you're loving is the soul. You're not loving the body. And it's funny because we've never seen the soul. You've never seen your husband. He's never seen you. You've never seen your children. They've never seen you. You've never seen your parents. They've never seen you. They've seen your body, but they actually haven't seen you as a soul. We can't even see spirit with these material eyes. But yet, although we haven't seen our husband and we haven't seen our wife, it's really that which we haven't seen that we love about them. And what we're seeing is not really what we love, you know, not ultimately. George Harrison wrote that song. It's interesting. There's two things to say about that. Something in the way she moves, like no other. You know that song? He was writing about Krishna. He was actually writing about Krishna. And he said, I didn't want to say something in the way he moves, because in England they would think I was a poofter. So instead of saying he wrote she. Something in the way he moves me like no other. That was actually a love song about Krishna. But even if you take it on the mundane level, you say something about there's something about that girl, the way she moves, that just really, you know, pushes my buttons, you see? But it's not, so what you're seeing is the body, and you're thinking that it's the body which attracts you. But it's not really the body which attracts you, because the body is moving the way it moves because of the soul, because of the nature of the soul inside. And the ultimate proof is, if you think you love the body, if you think that you're actually attached to what you see, the eyes and the hair and the hands and the calves and the waistline and all that stuff, if you think that's what you really love, then the acid test is, after death, after the soul leaves the body, then continue your life as normal with the body. Continue. Come on, honey, let's go to dinner, you know. Like that, you know. Come on, honey, let's go to dinner, you know. Let's go swimming. How about a little kiss, you know, in that cold marble gray pal? You know, it's actually macabre. I mean, it's just macabre to even think about that. So if that which we see is what we're attracted to, how come as soon as the soul leaves it, the attraction is gone, unless you're a very weird person? So it was really the soul that we were attracted to in the first place. It wasn't the body, see. So in Krishna consciousness, we try to love each other soul to soul. We try to love each other soul to soul. And we try to touch one soul to another. by always emphasizing spiritual topics, talking about the Lord, the soul of souls, the supreme soul, the source of all is, the service of the supreme soul. And we try to see ourselves as not materially related, because you have a father, his father's name is Grandis, and her father's name is Jensen, and my father's name is Warden. So to talk about love and brotherhood on the material platform is a little artificial, because if we're brothers and sisters, how come our fathers and mothers don't have the same last names? So there's differences in the material sense of it, but in the spiritual sense, we're all spirit souls, part and parcel of God. And on that level, on the level of who we really are, we can in fact have wonderfully meaningful spiritual relationships which are non-exploitative. We have in our ISKCON temples all over the world, we have beautiful boys and beautiful girls, and they're dancing beside each other, and yet the focus is on the Lord. And the emphasis is on serving the Lord. It's not on exploitative relationships. So this is these are the different layers that cover the soul. Now, as I was saying, the only vision which leads itself to a peaceful, harmonious, happy, fraternal society is the vision of the soul. If you see people in terms of their bodies, you'll see a lot of differences. When we have the Festival of Colors, which is coming up on Saturday, one of the comments that comes up all the time is, nobody cares who you are, nobody cares where you're from. And why is that? Because everyone's red and green and blue and purple and they look absolutely ridiculous, you know. And at that point, we lose our fear. We don't feel, you know, when we see a difference between someone, a male or a female or brown skinned versus black skinned or yellow skinned or white skinned, Muslim versus, the sort of reflexive, almost animalistic reaction is, you know, what do I have to lose here? What have I have to lose here? You know, we talk about the alien immigration law. I mean, if that isn't like uptight terminology, I don't know what it is. You know, you're calling someone who wants to come here an alien. In other words, you're presuming that they're going to take your jobs and date your daughters, and that's just a horrible, horrible thing. So because they're different, you know, there's all kinds of guards and defenses that are put up, and there's all kinds of hypertension and worry and tightness surrounding that, you see. But on the Festival of Colors, everybody's like different, but they're also the same. And some or other, we're not threatened at that point by the differences. Sometimes it's all, some or other, it's just transformed into kind of a humorous, relishable variegatedness. And we suspend all those calculations that normally kick into place when we meet someone. You know, we suspend all those reservations and those fears and those suspicions that pretty much live with us all day, every day. It says that in conditioned life, a person makes friends, enemies, and neutral parties depending on what good they're going to do me, how they're going to promote my plans and my selfish agenda. So if you're going to promote my agenda, then I'll ally myself with you so that collectively we can promote our agendas at the expense of others. If you've expressed antipathy to my goals or to me as a person, then I immediately classify you as an enemy because you're not going to help me push forward my own selfish ambitions. And if you haven't declared yourself one way or another, then you're a neutral party and I'm just waiting to see. So we're just going through life all the time with those counts. Where is love? Where is trust? Where is kinship? You see? We're actually put here to enjoy relationships with each other and relationships with God. That's why we're here. But because of these material calculations and these material differences and the barriers that come with them, we miss the whole point of life. And some or other, for a few hours at the Festival of Color, that's all just literally thrown to the winds. You know, it's all thrown to the wind. Nobody cares who you are. Nobody cares where you are. And everyone just loves everyone. Because ultimately, there's nothing that anyone can give you. There's nothing that anyone can take away from you. The greatest gift has already been given to you. God has created you as an eternal spirit soul. And He's created you uniquely. You have the gift of life. You have the gift of individuality. And that is the greatest gift. That is the greatest gift. You could be homeless on the street with no income and no means of support, but if you think about all the things that you are grateful for, you think about all the way that you were created, then you'll smile. A smile will come to your face. And everything else will recede into insignificance. Bhagavad Gita says, Nasochati Nakanchati. Who realizes their spirit soul, they don't hanker after anything, nor do they lament. Most of us, especially in our youth, we're hankering. Got to get a university education, got to get a wife, got to get a job, got to give a car, got to get a house like that. Got to. And then at the end of life, when we're being pushed out on the other end, we're lamenting. I'm losing my wife, I'm losing my youth, I'm losing my flexibility, I'm losing my financial portfolio. My mother called me up about 2 years before she died. She was in a nursing home. And she had a stroke. Her whole left side was paralyzed. And she took like a cocktail of drugs. I don't think she even like knew whether she was coming or going most of the time. But she called me up in what I think was a moment of lucidity. She called me up. She says, Chris, I spent the first half of my life accumulating things and the second half of my life losing things. Got to have it, and then lamenting, lost it. Get it, lost it. But if you realize you're an eternal spirit soul, there's really nothing to gain or nothing to lose. In fact, in the course of getting things, in the course of, you know, running the rat race and keeping up with the Joneses, we forget that we're most fortunate, that we're most glorious, that we're eternal. We forget that. Because we identify with stuff, which is dead, but the soul itself is alive. So here's the vision. Pandit, you've heard the word pandit, and I'll just wind up here because it's almost time for yoga. Sometimes you hear about a great musician like Ravi Shankar being called a pandit, or a politician like Nehru being called pandit, Pandit Ravi Shankar, Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru. But the word pandit in Bhagavad Gita is actually used not to refer to a politician or not to refer to a musician, but a pandit is samadarshana. It's one who sees everyone equally. And if you look at this pandit, he's sitting under the tree with his bead bag, and he's looking at what? Dogs and birds and lions and tigers and peacocks. And you see in the heart of each and every one of them is that spirit soul, that shining spark of eternal life. So he's not seeing in terms of all the differences, but he's seeing the commonality. He's seeing the eternal spiritual kinship that we all share one with another. And it's interesting too, because he seems to be, maybe you may say it's just the artist's license, but actually, you know, the fact is that he gets along with all different kinds of people a lot better than someone who sees materially. He's sitting there in the midst of a menagerie, and he seems to be getting along with them, and they seem to have no problem with him, nor with each other. And we try to cultivate that vision here, and we've got llamas, we've got peacocks, we've got cows, and everyone who comes marvels at the animals, how they don't run away in hysterical fear every time a human being approaches them. They actually have not lost their regard of us. We haven't terrorized them. They feel dependent upon us as younger brothers and sisters would depend on older brothers and sisters. And so there's a nice harmony that is achieved here based on that ambition of seeing everyone spiritually, everyone as being part and parcel of the Lord. So that's part one. We'll continue this next Tuesday. It's entitled Journey of the Soul.